Welcome to a new episode of the Film Experience Podcast. This is your host, Murtada El-Fadl, and I'm here with my co-host, Nathaniel Rogers. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi, Murtada.
And today we are going to talk about two movies that are kind of about the same subject. They're both a riff on an artist in the medium of film. So Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory, which is, as he calls it, autofiction, partially based on his life, and then the Judy Garland biopic Judy with Renee Zellweger. Which one do you want to start with, Nathaniel?
But let's start with Pedro.
Okay.
So for those who haven't heard anything about Pain and Glory, it is, as Murtada says, autofiction, which is, you know, parts of it are obviously based on his career, and Salvador Malo, the director played by Antonio Banderas in the film, is clearly modeled after Pedro. But there's all sorts of elements where you don't really know if that happened, including lots of drug use and like a stage play written anonymously, you know, and lots of things that I don't think really happened, or maybe not in the way that they're portrayed in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, at the New York Film Festival press conference, he said everything sort of happened to somebody he knows. It could not exactly him, but he said he took from his friends' lives, his family's lives, his brothers, his sisters, so people he knew. So it's all things that kind of sort of happened, but maybe not to him.
And it will not surprise listeners to know that I loved it, because Pedro is my favorite living director. And you loved it, too. You gave it an A in your review.
I was going to, can I give it an A++++? Because that's what I wanted to do. Yes, I loved it, too. So this is going to be a love fest for Pedro.
Okay, so when did you know you loved it? You know, because sometimes movies take a little bit to get going, and sometimes it's one scene.
I think I loved it really with the end. The end is so moving and brings it all together. I'm not going to give out the end, but no. Like the end frame is just so moving and just makes everything that happened in the 2 hours before so amazing. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks at that point, because then I realized what I've been watching. And I was sobbing and trying to, you know, they put the lights on and I was just trying to like hide, because, you know, you're in a press screening and everybody's, you know, a lot of people. And I'm like, I don't want them to see me doing this. But anyway, yeah, that's when it really hit me.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me, because a lot of his movies I find, I've literally never on second viewing of any of his movies, I have never liked it less. I've always liked it more than the first time I saw it. Because his movies have so many layers that, you know, it can be that cumulative effect. And so sometimes it takes till the ending, or the second time you're seeing it, you're like, oh my God. That was genius. I had that feeling at the ending as well, minus the sobbing, because I don't really do that in movies. But I wish I could. Honestly, I think I should go to a doctor. Yeah. Maybe something's wrong with my eyes. Yeah. But, or tear ducts rather. But, I loved it from the first scene. I thought the first scene was so beautiful, and it felt like you're watching like kind of like a glamorous dream, even though, you know, what's happening is not glamorous at all. It's women doing laundry.
Yeah.
But there's something so lush about his filmmaking style that it's like heightened reality as opposed to reality.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't go wrong when you start your movie with Penelope Cruz. But also, it's just, to your point, you know, that scene, you're, as somebody who loves Pedro, and who's seen all of his movies, I think you would recognize that scene as an Almodovar scene immediately, and that you are with him immediately in his world, with his muse, everything is happening. All the things that you love about him come to you in that first scene, and I guess that's why you loved it from the beginning.
I mean, I loved it from the beginning, so things that happen after that, sometimes I was weighing them against the beginning. Like, the movie, I think the bookends of the movie are both incredible. Like, one of my favorite opening scenes and one of the best endings ever. So it was in the middle where I was like, do I love this or do I just like it? So I was having that, that thing. It's not my favorite Pedro of all time, but I do love it.
I think it's my favorite Pedro of all time. And I think of it as, I also love Pedro. I've seen every movie of his. I've seen, I think, every movie of his several times. And for somebody, like, who loves his movie so much, I think this movie was a cathartic experience. Because as you're watching and as you're going along, you're seeing Pedro on screen, but you're also seeing so many themes and things that he has been obsessed with since the 80s, in all his movies, and all these themes come together, and by the end you're like, I've seen his quote-unquote dissertation on his life and his work, and and that makes it, as a fan of Pedro, makes it a very cathartic experience. So I think it's a culmination of all the things that he's been doing and all the things that I've loved about his movies, which is why I think, I mean, you know, this is a new love, why I think it's my favorite of his movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say in regards to that casting Antonio as him was a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
Because it's, and we're going to talk about this later with Judy. when you see someone that you know really well playing someone else you know really well,
mm-hmm.
there's this weird, like, sort of fusion where you can where you feel like you're watching both of them at the same time. Mm-hmm. And if they're connected, which in this case they are, not in the case of Renee and Judy, but if they're connected in your mind and heart, it creates, at least in this circumstance, I can't recall that I've seen something exactly like this before, but they're so connected in my heart that mm-hmm. to see this version that is both of them fused was very moving to me for the whole movie. Like, this is my favorite Antonio Banderas performance ever, and I am one of those people who thinks he's a good actor. I know some people do not. But I thought he was great in Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and some of the early Almodovars, and in occasional English language pictures.
Yeah, he is, I agree with you, he's fantastic in this film. And also, he's not exactly doing an imitation of Pedro, but every once in a while he will stress a line, or do a body movement, or walk two steps, and you're like, and you're just like, wow, that's Pedro on screen. So it's a homage, if not an 100% imitation.
Right. Which is also something we're going to be talking about with Judy.
Yeah.
So it's like a weird thing that they're both out at the same time in the movie theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. In regards to that, I do wonder how people who are not diehard Pedro fans, as obviously both of us are, I do wonder what they'll make of this movie, because do you need that sort of base love and understanding of who Pedro is as an artist to fully appreciate this movie? I wonder about that.
Yeah, I don't know, because, I mean, all of my love for this movie comes from that, so I don't know. But just as a movie, I think there are things there that people can recognize, like one of those moving scenes is this scene where Salvador Mayo reconnects with his ex-lover. And I think that scene plays well to everybody who's ever been in love and lost and all these things, and how, because the conversation they have is so beautiful. It's about how you grow when you're together and how you grow when you're apart. And it's such a poignant scene that I think everybody who's ever, everybody who's been in a relationship would appreciate that scene. And then, of course, one of the biggest themes going through the movie, as in all Pedro's movie, is about, you know, mothers and children and disappointment and love between them and all these things, which I guess is another hook for people who might not be as familiar with Pedro.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. And there's also, as there often is, there's little things for the LGBT community to enjoy.
Yes.
As well, like his childhood, Salvador's childhood, there's this, I'm not going to spoil anything because it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, but there's this moment where where it's really comical if you're a gay man, but I wonder, I bet it would play as more of like a dramatic scene if you were straight, or
yeah,
if you hadn't had that sort of feeling as a child that you didn't know how to like put into words.
Yeah. Yes.
So I found that scene really, really funny, but also moving.
Yeah. And just, there are so many things in this film, right? Like the story, it's a very nostalgic story. It's about memory. It's about sort of recollecting your memories and going back. And so there is a plot and there are things that happen. So if you just even, you know, I'm talking myself into people loving this movie, even if they don't love Pedro. Like, so even if you're just going to see like a plotty movie, there is like enough plot and enough moving plot to get you to love this film.
Mm-hmm. I will say one of the areas where Pedro, one of my very rare complaints about his filmography, which is a very minor complaint because obviously I've said over and over he's my favorite director.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think sometimes his movies are too plotty. So in that way, I liked this one.
Yes, it's not as plotty as the rest. Yes.
Because they have, his movies tend to err on the side of being sort of novelistic. Like, there's just so much going on, and there's so mm-hmm. many subplots, and there's usually some degree of monologuing that's actually exposition, which kind of makes me crazy, because I hate that in other people's movies, but with him, I tolerate it.
Same. There's always people sitting around telling you what's happening.
Right.
Which doesn't work for any other filmmaker except for him. He somehow, I don't speak Spanish, so I don't know what it is. It must be the cadences. There's something in the way his people talk to each other and the stories they tell and spin that's just a little bit more than when another filmmaker does it.
It's like storytelling within storytelling.
Yeah.
He loves to do that, which he also does in this movie.
But not as much, to your point. Not as much as usual. Like, there are a few scenes, you know, they're just in the kitchen talking, telling you what's happening. But, but there is so much love for, like, you know, this is Pedro talking to, like, for instance, that scene in the very beginning where Cecilia Roth from All About My Mother appears. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, wow, look at Pedro, which is not Pedro, but Antonio, talking to Cecilia Roth, and you're like, oh, remember how great she was in All About My Mother. And, you know, that's where I was when I was watching that scene.
Yeah, and I think that's where you're meant to be. So this is clearly a love letter both to himself and to his fan base.
Yes, yeah.
Because that scene with Cecilia Roth, I don't think this is a spoiler because it's a extremely minor point in the movie. It's like the only scene that addresses it. But she wants a part in his next feature.
Yes.
And so it becomes this thing where you're watching it and you're also watching your vision of Cecilia Roth and Pedro and you're like, yeah, why haven't you put her in a movie lately? You know?
I think, wasn't she in I'm So Excited? But, you know, I think it was such a small part, nobody remembers.
Right.
But it is, and then she's in this movie, so it's like meta over meta over meta, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's asking for a part, and then you're watching her in the part. So, it's very fun.
Yeah. So, yeah, two huge recommendations for Pain and Glory.
Yeah, and just go and see it, and talk to other people who love Pedro, because it's so great.
And as always the case with, like, movies that open in platform, it's important that you go as soon as possible because they only expand in relation to how many people are going in the first few weeks.
Yeah.
So make sure you get there as soon as it's available in your city.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the movies that were at Cannes now, most of them that were in the competition, and you know what? Pedro gets my Palme d'Or. I've seen Parasite, I love Parasite, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, all these movies that people loved at Cannes, this would have gotten my Palme d'Or.
Wow. Yeah, I knew you loved it, but wow. I'm a Parasite voter between the two of them, but I love both of the movies. And which is a perfect segue to the Best International Feature Film category, as we're talking Oscar on this podcast.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do, but in this case, we have two very specific categories to discuss based on the movies. So Best International Film, it looks like Parasite already has it in the bag, but it's way too early for that, especially since South Korea has never been nominated.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, people are very enthusiastic about it. People love it.
Yeah.
The fact that I totally thought it was going to win the audience award at TIFF because they kept adding screenings and everybody was just so in love with it. And in the end, it came third, I think, right?
Yeah.
So it's there, it's in the mix.
Which is coincidentally the same thing that Roma did, third place.
Yeah, yes, that's true. And I think this is a much more sort of fun and accessible movie than Roma. They are both great movies, but this is just, like, it's a crowd pleaser. Like, there is no other way to put it. It's just a crowd pleaser. Like, you go, you're like in there, you're having an experience with the crowd, with the characters. It's such a crowd pleasing movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie theater movie because it's so twisty and it has so many laughs and other things because it's like all genres at once, basically. It's great to see with a crowd. And yeah, I think it's probably going to win if it's nominated, but I'm still nervous about a shocking snub just because they've done it before to movies.
But
in that
they
category.
Have the committee still, right? Like the committee can add one
the
or
committee
two
can,
or whatever.
See, here's the weird part about this is I don't think the committee will have to pull rank here.
Yeah.
Because I think it's enough of a crowd pleaser that it could easily make the top 10 without the three. Or the top seven of the general voters without the committee putting it in. Because how it works is they get the general screening committees get... Well, now they've moved up to 10. It used to be 9 finalists, but now it's going to be 10.
So finally, that makes so much more sense. 9 was
so
such an odd number.
I was talking to... a little bit off the record. I was talking to two of the... executive committee members, the chair. This is not, I'm joking about being off the record, because they knew I was interviewing them. But they told me, or when they told me, like, the rules of the category, they were going over that, and they were talking about how they had increased it to 10, and I said, I'm just going to pretend that that's because you've been reading my site over and over again, because every single year... I have complained about that 9. It makes no sense. Other categories are 10 finalists or 15.
Yeah.
So anyway, so how it works is, for people who don't know, is the general screening committees who are tasked with seeing a certain number of the contenders from the 88 or so submissions.
Uh-huh.
And the number they're tasked with seeing before they can vote changes based on the number of submissions. So it's some percentage.
Okay.
So last year, I think they had to see 12 or 13 before they could vote. So it's like all these different people voting, and they rate the movies on a scale of 7 to 10.
Okay.
So they're not actually, like, putting in votes. Like, I'm voting for these 5. They're voting on
these
15.
Oh, okay.
And so then they collate and figure out what the 7 are, and then the executive committee meets, and they choose an additional 3.
Mm.
And then for the final round of voting, very different, then you have to have seen all 10 of the movies to vote, and you can not be involved at all in the preliminary voting and come in at the end as long as you've seen those 10 movies and can prove you've seen them, because they have screenings or whatever, then you can vote. And like Best Picture, this is the part I didn't know, and like Best Picture, it's preferential voting.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, so you
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. So you actually rank your top 5 within the 10.
Yeah. Cool.
So that's a little, like, education this morning, listeners, or this evening, depending on when you're listening.
Yeah, so I think definitely Parasite is in, and so is Pedro. Because just those two filmmakers are very well respected.
Yes.
And I think they're in Best Director, too.
That would be something if both of them got in. That would be kind of incredible.
Yeah. I think they are. I mean, You know, Pedro Almodovar is doing a big, huge campaign for this Oscar. He's in New York. He's everywhere. He's in the New York Times. He's at the New York Film Festival. At the screening I was too, there was a documentary crew following him who sat right next to us, who were filming him as he went through the New York Film Festival. And she was asking me, do you think he has a chance to win the Oscar? So I think people are excited in Spain about him being in the Oscar, which, you know, he has put in the years, and with how the director's branch have become so international, I think he's in. He's beloved, and he made a movie. If you love him, you can't help but love it.
That's true. That's true.
And directors are going to be impressed that he was able to make a movie about his life, about movies, about making movies that's like that. That's so well done and so moving.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. You've convinced me. Now you just have to convince the other 9,000 members of the Academy.
Yes. But
otherwise, with international film, who's to say what's going to end up in the top five? Because there's a lot of, like, really good contenders this year.
Yeah. I mean, two of them that I saw at New York and were, you know, top of the movies I saw there, top five, are Beanpole from Russia, which is crazy bonkers.
I'm seeing it tonight.
Yeah, it's so crazy, but it's also just so, like, the filmmaking is top level.
And that's a new director, and he's, like, super young.
Yes. That's the hindrance, though. It's a great movie, but he has no cachet. He's not known, and he doesn't have, like, a media hook for him to be known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I don't know. But the other one definitely has that, Matty Diop's Atlantiques. It's an amazing film, and she's already won something in Cannes. She won second prize in Cannes after Parasite, I think.
She did.
And, you know, she has a great media story, so she has an advantage there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a contender for the finalist list for sure, Atlantiques. Yeah. And it's very good.
Yeah.
And it will be streaming on Netflix at some point. Not sure when, but hopefully before the end of the year, but who knows. Like, for example, they had Girl, that Belgian submission for the Oscar, a year or two ago, forget when. And they waited so long to start streaming that. Like, until after.
But that was a controversial film.
It was, but it was, at the beginning, it was in this position where everybody thought it was going to be really well received, and then it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But they had it, but, you know, and then they didn't, you know, do anything with it type of thing. So you never know with them.
Yeah, that's true.
So shall we move on to Judy?
Let's move. But do you want to give people what, do you have predictions for who will be nominated in international feature before we move to Judy beyond Pedro and Parasite?
I'm going with Les Miserables from France.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil, The Invisible Life of Eurydice Guzmão. I think that's going to move a lot of people. And right now I'm predicting Norway outstealing horses just because I'm being stubborn, because I had predicted that, like, in April. And, you know, who knows? But I think that's more of, like, mainstream, like, what this category used to go for.
Okay.
I personally, of the submissions, I am absolutely crazy about Sweden's submission, but I'm kind of doubtful it will get in. It's a Georgian movie, even though it's from Sweden. It's all in Georgian.
Mm-hmm.
But Georgia would never accept the movie because it's very, very gay.
What's it about?
It is about two male dancers who are both auditioning to be part of, like, the national Georgian dance troupe, basically. So they do all these famous, like, you know, archival works, you know, like how a lot of dance companies do.
Yeah.
And so basically the environment they're in is like a lot of artistic environments. There's no money in it. And the only way you can be successful is if you're in, like, the top, top tier. And the top, top tier is this, is the national troop because they're actually paid, you know.
Oh, got it.
So they're both in, like, a lower level dance thing, and basically it's a romantic drama.
Okay. That sounds interesting.
But the dancing is amazing. They cast real dancers, and the director, the reason it's Sweden's submission is the director is Swedish-Georgian. He's born in Sweden, raised in Sweden, but his family's Georgian, and he's, you know, so he went to Georgia to make this movie. But Georgia's very, very anti-gay. Like,
Okay.
And so the movie, a lot of it is about sort of the anti-gay climate in Georgia as well.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But it's very good. Like, I found it extremely, extremely good. I can't stop thinking about it, actually.
Wow. But that's an endorsement.
Yes, but because it's so queer, I'm not really suspecting that it'll, you know, get Oscar excited.
It's a queer category this year because the director of The Invisible Life of Eurydice is also queer. Yeah. Or am I getting that wrong?
No, I believe he is. Karim Anouz.
Yes.
And Pedro, of course.
Yeah.
And the Swedish movie, I mean, the content, I know nothing about the director other than where his family's from. Yeah. Oh, and Bolivia is also a gay film from a gay filmmaker.
Yeah, which is playing at New Fest, which starts in New York in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to see it there.
Yeah, it's called I Miss You, and it's based on a stage play that he did that was a huge, massive hit in Bolivia and caused, like, a lot of movement within gay rights there because it was so popular.
Yeah.
So he's kind of a celebrity at home. But hasn't broken out in sort of international cinema ways, really.
Exciting. Lots of great movies. So I look forward to seeing all these ones that you just mentioned that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah. And a few of the submissions are streaming on Netflix, which we've covered on the site about. We'll include a link with the podcast. A lot of them are streaming now. I just watched Vietnam's entry last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved Taiwan's entry, Dear X, which is a gay comedy, so that's also gay.
Cool.
Okay. Judy.
I think we've kept our listeners waiting enough. I think everybody wants to know what you thought of Judy and of Renee. So you have the floor, Nathaniel. Tell us about your thoughts on Renee and Renee as Judy.
So, for those of you who have been asleep or in a coma and are just returning to the world, Judy is a biopic about the last days of Judy Garland. It's her last concerts that she gave in London, basically, before her death. And so Renee Zellweger plays Judy, and it's based on a stage play. So it feels that way in a lot of ways because the stage play only has two sets, from what I understand. I haven't seen the play.
Yeah, it has just the club and her hotel room. Yeah.
Right. So a lot of scenes are in those two places, but they do open it up a little bit, including one scene very much like a bouquet of roses to friends of Dorothy all over the world.
Yeah. giving the fans what they want.
Right, exactly. You know, portraying Judy as like sort of this gay saint, you know.
Yeah.
Gay-friendly saint, which I don't know about the total truth of that because a lot of celebrities from the golden age who are beloved by the queer community were not always so unequivocally actually pro-gay because of the time periods in which they lived. So who knows if Jodie was waffling a bit here and there, but in the movie she's like, gay rights!
She is.
So.
From 50 years ago.
Yeah. So, Renee. Here's the thing. Everybody knows that I'm obsessed with Judy Garland and that I don't like Renee Zellweger. So I'll just put that out there first, which is why everybody's been so curious what I thought. So I had a little trouble at the beginning of the movie because I was resisting it, you know, as one does, because one brings oneself into movie theaters. People always pretend that they don't have biases, but they do.
Yeah.
And she won me over.
Wow. Go Renee.
I don't think it's a perfect performance, and I certainly don't understand why everybody wants her to win a second Oscar. If she were to win, you know, she doesn't need a second Oscar because a great performance basically makes up for her winning the Oscar for a bad performance. So you don't need to give her a second Oscar.
But she's given other great performances.
Yes, but my point is, I thought she was really good in the movie. So anybody who's a Renee fan who hates me for hating her, I think she was really good in it. But I do think, like Antonio Banderas in Pain and Glory, it's like this thing where you're seeing both people at once. So it's not one of these performances like, I'm trying to think of an example.
That's a complete immersion in just doing the, like, famous person.
Yeah, like they become, you know, if I read reviews of that, I'm just going to throw them in the trash for this movie. Because she's always Renee Zellweger in this movie. But there's moments where you can see the Judy mannerisms, which she doesn't do it all the time. So yep. It's like a little limited as a performance goes because it's sort of both at once. It's like Renee's tics and some of Judy's tics. And it's sort of like, it's these two personas that are sort of coexisting. It's sort of like a ghost, like old TV's ghost images. That's how I viewed the performance. But I did think it was good. Like, I don't want to be misunderstood. I just didn't think it was transcendent. But I did think she was really good in it. I thought she got to the emotional meat of it, which is important. And I actually think the movie is pretty okay. Like, people are acting like the movie's bad. Like, it's not a great film, but I don't really understand the people saying it's a bad movie.
Yeah. I loved Renee in this movie.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just going to say, I loved her. I was moved by her so much. I agree that she doesn't go full Judy, but she gives her idea of Judy, but it's also a very smart, clever idea. I think both she and the script land on a note, and they played very well. The note is about the core sadness of Judy Garland, and the script is about that. They present Judy as a very sad, tragic figure, which she was, and Renee really latches onto that and gives you this very moving performance. You can't help but be moved by her and what she does at Judy, and which is why I loved her. I think it is not an expansive Judy movie, neither in the performance or in the script. Like, you know, Judy had so many other aspects to her life and to her character, even later in life. And to present this, they just did one note, but they did it so well. The movie's so moving, and it's also really telling you, like, you know, you mentioned already sort of like, you know, they were playing up to the gay fans, but they were also playing up to the Judy fans. Because if you're a Judy fan, you can't help but be affected by what's happening on screen and what Renee is doing. So, you know, from that perspective, well done.
Yeah, I would use what you're saying there to amend what I was saying before. I don't think it's a bad movie, but I do think it's an extremely limited movie. And this gets to what you're saying about they picked one angle. I do think a great film, there could be a great film in the material, but it's not there. So I think that might be why people are saying it's not a good movie. Because it is kind of limited. It's limited in its point of view. It's limited in its sort of what it's trying to achieve. It's not particularly ambitious. But I think for what it is, I personally prefer biopics that are like this in that they only try to take a tiny portion of someone's life, because I hate the ones that do the full birth to death.
Yeah.
And that said, I didn't like any of the scenes that were about the young Judy. I thought that was very distracting.
Oh my God. So bad. Those scenes were so bad. You know, yeah. I don't know. I think those scenes are there for people who don't know Judy Garland, so they can sort of like have an idea about her life, because that's the only function they're there for. But yes, whenever they went back, it was just like, oh, just get me back to Renee, please.
Okay, so I amend again. It's a bad movie. I'm just remembering how bad all those young Judy scenes were.
Yes. I do want to say one more thing about the, you know, the limitation of the film. Like, Judy Garland, even in 1967, just 7 months, 6 months before she died, which is where the bulk of this movie takes place, there was more to her than just a sad, lonely has-been, which is what the movie presents. There are more things they could have, you know, at that time, she was still, you know, one of the best performers in the world, somebody who has been on top, somebody who had a personality that I think was, sometimes when you watch her in those TV clips on YouTube, she was abrasive, she was funny, she was intimidating even.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this movie does not get at that at all. It's all just about Sad Judy.
Mm-hmm.
Sad Judy is very moving, and you can't help but be moved by her. And the movie is so in love with her and wants to pay homage to Judy, to her fans, to her career and all of that. But I just wish they, you know, presented somebody a little bit more with thorns. There are, you know, mm-hmm. Judy in this movie. The way the script is, the way the movie is filmed, and the way Renee plays her doesn't have any of that.
Yeah. Hence our discussions about the limited nature of both the movie and the performance, even though Renee's very good.
She's very good. You know what? If she wins the Oscar, I'm fine. I'll be fine with it. It's good. It's a good performance.
I will not. I will not.
She's not my favorite, but she is there. She's up there. She's very good.
This is going to be a long Oscar season for me, even though it's a short Oscar season.
But Nathaniel, just remember, like, we're still in October. I know people now, the movie just be released, everybody's seeing it, talking about
and
why
this
everybody...
time last year, as I think you pointed out, everybody was convinced Lady Gaga was going to win Best Actress.
And A Star Is Born was going to win 5 Oscars. And, you know, that didn't happen. So, we'll see. It's still silly days, yeah.
Any other questions for me about Judy?
What did you think of the singing?
Ooh, I knew people were going to ask that, and I knew you might ask that, and I didn't want to answer, but I will say this, because I've heard people say she's terrible. Like, I've heard a lot of people complaining about that, and I complained about that when I heard she was doing her own singing and when I saw the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say even that kind of won me over, because I think it was because of the way Renee was sort of playing herself and Judy at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because she does the same thing in the singing that she's doing in the acting, where it's sort of Judy, but not really Judy.
Yeah.
So there are weird Judy inflections and things that come up in the vocals. I actually think Renee must have had a lot of training, because her singing's way better than it used to be. It's way better singing than she did in Chicago.
Look at Nathaniel, all these positive for Renee Zellweger. Wow.
Shut up. I'm not endorsing the Oscar win. I just want to make
this
very clear.
That's not what I said. You like your singing, that's all.
But with the caveat that Judy Garland is the world's greatest entertainer, so I fear people interpreting Judy in a certain way because, you know, their reference point is only Wizard of Oz in this movie. And she's really, like, the greatest of all time. I did like that moment early in the movie where she goes to a party that Liza Minnelli's at.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's talking to her, and it's like, oh, my God, the world's greatest entertainer is in the room. And she's like, oh, is Frank Sinatra here? And she says it in kind of a bitchy way. It was one of my favorite moments in the movie because it acknowledged one of my biggest pet peeves about the entire American culture when it comes to Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra. In that Judy, that's her title, the world's greatest entertainer, and yet people started calling Frank Sinatra that, and now people think that that was his title. But that was originally Judy's title. And New York, New York, which people also think of as a Frank Sinatra song, was written for Liza Minnelli, and Liza Minnelli popularized it. So it's basically like Frank Sinatra is constantly fucking with the praise that should be going to Judy and Liza. So I have issues with that. I just want to say that. And if you ever heard me on that podcast, I don't think so, honey. Las Culturista. I went off on this thing with Frank Sinatra and Liza Minnelli. So if you'd like to listen to that Las Culturistas episode, you should. I'll link to it.
I just want to say one thing about Renee's singing. Renee is playing Judy literally in the last 6 months of her life.
That's true.
So she didn't, if people were expecting her to be singing when she's, like she sang in Meet Me in St. Louis or The Wizard of Oz, like, that's not true. She is trying to do Judy at the end of her life. And I think she doesn't sound like Judy, but I think she approximates, playing somebody whose instrument is not as strong as it was. And she does that really well.
Yeah. Which is, I think, why I was okay with the vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you, like, Judy's voice was shot by that point, or at least shot in terms of not being the greatest voice of all time at that point. Here's what I want to say for people who don't know Judy Garland that well. You need to watch the 1963 movie, I Could Go On Singing, because it would be a great companion piece to this movie, because it is a fictional movie, but Judy's basically playing a version of herself in that movie, and it's like a concert tour movie, so you see a lot of concerts, and this is from 1963, so it's a little bit before the events of Judy.
Yes.
Sort of between the Judy Carnegie Hall thing that was so famous, and the last concert series in London before she died. So it's like a good middle point to see what she was like. I highly recommend people see that.
And it's on YouTube, so hurry up before they pick it out.
Yeah.
I've seen it on YouTube. I watched it after I watched Judy, because somebody was like, oh, it's on YouTube, so I went and watched it. Yeah. And yeah. You're right about that.
Yeah, and her voice, even though it doesn't sound like it did in the 40s, her voice is still, you still get the total sense of how magnificent a performer she was on stage.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you get from this movie. Like, even though I liked Renee's performance, and I think she did a valiant thing with whatever she did with vocal training, but that would be one of my biggest drawbacks of this movie, is like, I was talking to Nick about this, who I invited to this podcast, but he's in Iceland right now, living it up on a Reykjavik film festival.
Nice.
But he said, I didn't ever get the sense this was the world's greatest entertainer. You know, there's nothing about it that suggests that she was ever regarded in that way in terms of how charismatic she is. Like, the movie's a little limited in that way.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. But, you know, if we're going to talk about Best Actress, you know who I'm really high on from the sort of what people are considering shoo-ins to be nominated?
What's
and I
that?
Never thought I'd say this. Scarlett Johansson rocked my world in Marriage Story. I think she's so amazing.
I mean, isn't that movie sensational?
I don't know that I love the movie, but I love her. I loved her in that film so much. And I was very surprised that the buzz coming out of TIFF was that Adam Driver. And I love Adam Driver. This is how I went in the movie. I went in the movie as a huge fan of Adam Driver, and like, I don't care about Scarlett Johansson. And I left as like Scarlett's new stan.
I mean, it's a great part for her. And yeah, she's great in it. But I did think Adam Driver was like the MVP of that movie, but it's a great movie. I mean, I was crazy about that movie. It's going to be in my top five for sure. Spoiler alert for my top 10 list.
I mean, Adam Driver is fantastic, but Scarlett Johansson is just, she is playing this woman who's trying to find herself, and like, you feel like she's finding the performance as she's giving it, and she's doing so many things, and she gets so many moments, you know, little and big. Like, there are big scenes, and then there are just moments where she's just doing a couple of things, and she's just fantastic in everything. I don't think she's ever been better. I just love this performance. Go Scarlett.
Yeah, and you know, young actors, you know they're going to use this movie for audition pieces. Because there's all these monologues in it. Scarlett has a monologue about finding herself that's pretty great.
Yes.
When she's talking to Laura Dern about her marriage. And, like, I think I haven't seen the... I mean, I saw the movie in the heat of Toronto, so I may be misremembering. But I think it's an unbroken shot, right? She just talks.
Yeah, I think so. It's a very long show. She talks, she goes into the bathroom, she comes out, you know, they are still following her, whatever she's doing. Yeah, it's a very long shot, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, she's great in it. You know, can I tell you somebody I was disappointed in, and I'm so sad to say this?
Mm-hmm.
Cynthia Erivo and Harriet.
The performance or the movie?
The movie and the performance. The movie is not very good, which upset me because I, you know, was really rooting for Cassie Lemons. She made Eve's Bio, of course, and, you know, she hasn't made a big movie in a while. So, like, I was really rooting for it, but I just thought it was kind of, I don't know, just flat, average.
Yeah. I kind of agree and I don't agree. After I watched the movie, which I enjoyed because it's a good story.
Yeah, it is a good
story. And all of that. And I agree that it's not a great, great movie. But I read Cam Collins' review in Vanity Fair, and that made me appreciate the movie more. It was very generous with sort of digging into how this movie went beyond the usual Oscar bait biopic. So I encourage everybody, maybe after Harriet is released, go and read that review. We'll link to it. It just made me appreciate that more. And what I appreciated about Cynthia Erivo in that film is, she's doing so much more than the other actors. I think all the other actors are playing the obvious notes of biopic, but she's digging a little deeper. So just in comparison with everybody she's on screen with, I thought the performance popped. Would I put it in a top five? I don't think so, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, she has the benefit of playing a role that is tailor-made to get you an Oscar nomination in every way.
Yeah.
But my chief problem with the performance, and not just the movie, but the performance, is that Harriet's kind of fully formed really early in the movie. So there's not really an arc, and I thought given how incredible Harriet Tubman's life story was, that there would be more, and given how many years the movies cover, that I thought I would feel differently about her by the end of the movie than I did at the beginning. But to me, it's very sort of, she's already fully Harriet Tubman, and you just follow her for several years.
Yeah.
It was just unsatisfying to me, and I was really rooting for her because I love her, and she's great on Color Purple on Broadway. And it's like the fun thing if she could be an EGOT person if she won this Oscar. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't think it's like, I don't think she's going to win, but I think you think it's, you have her third after Renee and Scarlett.
Yeah, I think she'll get nominated. I mean, I just think it's the nature of the role and of her career right now. She's like completely like a skyrocketing star.
Yeah.
I didn't like it nearly as much as like Lupita or, Scarlett or Renee, you know, in terms of a
performance. I agree with that. It's definitely not at that level. You know who I really want, and I don't know if you've seen Clemens yet, but come on, people, get Alfre Woodard. This is her year. Get her in those five.
Yeah, I still need to see that. I have it available to me, and I'm just struggling to find the time, but I will make the time.
Yeah, she's great. The movie might not be everybody's cup of tea because it's a very heavy film, but she's so great, and she gets such a showcase, and the movie basically plays 50% of its time on her face. So if there was ever a showcase for an award-winning performance, it's that movie.
Yeah, and so many actors, I haven't seen this movie yet, but based on what you've told me and what I've read, so many actors have been nominated for less.
Yeah.
And also, it's like great career, enduring actor that everybody loves. Like, it would be a great opportunity.
Yeah.
If people see the movie.
Yeah. And I know, like, people love Saoirse Ronan and Charlize Theron, but I'm just like, if they're not going to win for these parts, so if they're just going to crowd this category and crowd out Alfre, I'm just like, get Alfre in, people.
You know who I'm really, really hoping for still is Lupita. I know it's probably insane, but she was so inspired in Us.
It's not insane because, like you said, she was inspired. She was great. So from that perspective, I don't think it's insane. But is she going to campaign? Because, you know, who knows? Maybe she will.
Yeah. If she campaigns, I could see it happening. I mean, it was a huge hit. And even though people say, oh, Oscar doesn't like horror, they like horror better than some genres they don't recognize often in terms of acting.
Mm-hmm.
There's been quite a few over the years. Not as many as there should have been, of course, but they're not immune to the charms of great actors being inspired in horror movies.
Yeah. I mean, at this time in the year of Get Out, nobody was saying Daniel Kaluuya was going to get nominated.
Right.
So who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it'll be one of those things where everybody starts their list, she's always on it, and then she becomes a shoo-in. Who knows?
Yeah.
Because sometimes weird things happen like that.
Yeah. I mean, who should be on everybody's list, but of course the movie's in French, is Adèle Haenel in Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Oh, I love her.
That is a great performance. And like Alfre, the girl gets all the close-ups.
Including this incredible, I'm going to mention it in my review, which I'm working on right now, because the movie has one more showing at New York Film Festival next weekend, which if you're in New York, you should try to see it. It's so good. And, of course, France did not submit it for Best International Film, so it needs the support now more than ever in terms of fans and critics going to see it.
I think critics are going to give it so many awards. I would not be surprised if Adèle Haenel won L.A. and New York.
Yeah, I mean, and she has this, it's not quite her, oh no, it actually is her first shot on screen is such an homage to Meryl Streep as French Lieutenant's Woman in a way. And it's just this incredible introduction scene. Incredible.
Yeah.
And like, it's like one of these things that will be on, if Adèle Haenel ends up being a legendary figure, it will be on the centerpiece of, or the intro to every clip reel of her career.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, the movie is, because she is kind of the subject of the film, but she is not the biggest part in the film, but like every moment is impactful for her and she delivers. And when the camera is on her, it's like, whoa, just go. And she goes and
she's the subject, but not the protagonist.
Yeah.
Essentially. Because for those of you who haven't been following along, it's about an artist hired to paint a portrait of this lady. And the portraits are used to get the lady's husbands or marriage proposals because, you know, this is the days before email and Instagram and such. So it was the way to show what people looked like. So you tried to make them people beautiful in portraits so that people in other countries and far away could decide if they were into them. Swipe right or swipe left with an oil painting.
Yeah. So you wish for Lupita, I wish for Alfre.
Yeah.
We think Adele is great. Who else do you hope people take notice of in Best Actress that we haven't talked about?
I mean, it is, like I'm always saying, there's never a weak year in Best Actress, but this is a weaker year, if you know what I'm saying. There aren't as many, like, insanely great performances as there usually are. But I think if you really want to weigh your options, you should be looking at people like Julianne Moore and Gloria Bell, Elizabeth Moss and Her Smell, which I still haven't seen, but people swear by that performance.
She's so great. So good. But that's such an alienating performance that it's too polarizing because she's playing the most hateable person in the world. So.
Yeah. And if I were the campaigners, I might actually try to get Jennifer Lopez to compete in the lead category. Not because I think she's a lead. I think it's a borderline. I'm okay with it being described either way. But I think she could get in and Best Actress. And that's slightly more prestigious. Slightly.
But the lines are blurred. But she could win Best Supporting. I think she has a great chance to win Best Supporting.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
So I say stay in Supporting, win that Oscar, J-Lo. I'm behind you.
I think Laura Dern's going to win. That's my early prediction.
Can I disagree with you about that now that I've seen Marriage Story?
Yeah.
I think Laura Dern is fantastic, and the crowd around me was so into her every time she appeared. But it's like we said about Judy, it's a very limited part. She does not get to play all colors of the rainbow like her, like Adam and Scarlett do.
Yeah.
She plays this one note very loudly to the hilt, but it's very limited. And I frankly don't see it as an Oscar-winning performance unless it's just like, let's give Laura Dern a career Oscar.
Well, that's if what that's, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that campaign could easily happen. I mean, she's beloved within the industry. She's only been nominated twice, so this would only be a third nomination. But on the other hand, she feels kind of an Annette Bening type of person to me, where everybody loves and respects her, but for whatever reason, they don't feel the need to actually hand her trophies.
Yeah, and like if you have J-Lo versus Laura Dern, Laura Dern on her third nomination, somebody so very well respected, an Academy insider, everybody's going to think, you know what, she's going to be back next year, but when is J-Lo going to be back? Let's just give J-Lo the Oscar. And but I think that might...
I agree, but that's why some of the greats never win, because people have these like obsessions with they'll be back, which is just not true. It's hard to get an Oscar nomination unless your name is Meryl Streep.
I'm just analyzing the race, Nathaniel. I'm not saying this is what I'm doing.
What, am I yelling at you? Is that what you're implying?
Yes, a little bit.
I get very heated. We're talking about Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress, only the two most exciting categories every year.
And I'm really excited to see J-Lo versus Laura Dern. That's amazing. Go for it. But I love them both, but I love J-Lo more. I love her performance more. Do get it, J-Lo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting. If they're both nominated, it might potentially pull a lot of focus from Best Actress.
Yeah.
Like people might actually be more excited about Supporting Actress this year.
Yeah. I think it has a lot of like, you know, a lot of great narratives in there for who's in contention. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I love Scarlett, but what is her narrative? And I don't think it's that exciting. And Renee is great, and people seem to love the Renaissance or whatever it's being called, but that's also a limited narrative.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us in the comments who, somebody we didn't mention in Best Actress, who you hope voters or critics will notice before the end of the year?
Eager to hear your takes on this. Surprise us. There's a lot of room for discussion. This is the problem with anointing frontrunners early, as the media has done with Renee Zellweger, is that really blocks conversation from happening. And what we should be conversing about at this point is who's worthy, not who's going to win. Thanks for listening. Rush out to see Pain and Glory. Squeeze Judy in if you can. That's my recommendation.
I second that recommendation. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you very soon.